I don't think Casey DeSantis will be governor, but I also speculated that they were floating Casey DeSantis to try to slow down Byron Donald's momentum, his fundraising momentum. He's getting, daily, he was already getting lots of people to endorse him, whether they were, you know, county Republican Party chairmen, state committee men and women, you know, county commissioners, state committee men, or state house, state senate members. All of those folks have been, you know, Byron Donalds has done what he needed to do over the last 6 or 8 months for this moment for him to run for governor. Byron Donalds was a huge DeSantis supporter, which is the crazy thing. Matt Gaetz and Ron DeSantis, or and Byron Donalds were helped Ron DeSantis. They actually were the debate team for Ron DeSantis in 2018. They prepped Ron DeSantis for his debate. And in 2023, after 5 or 6 years of being completely loyal to one another, Ron DeSantis or Byron Donalds had the gall to, you know, kind of disagree with Ron DeSantis on a policy issue, which had to do with teaching African-American studies in Florida schools. And Byron Donalds disagreed with him. And so then Ron DeSantis says, you're out. And is in 2017, Donald Trump practiced the politics of subtraction. And today he's practicing the politics of addition. It's a totally different president. And because he's bringing in people like Tulsi Gabbard and Elon Musk, and go down the list of people who in 2017, Marco Rubio, who would not be part, Vivek Ramaswamy early on, like those folks would not have been part of a Donald Trump administration. And yet he's bringing those folks in. And there's a lot of folks who emulate Donald Trump in politics who are still practicing that 2016, 2017 version of Donald Trump with the politics of subtraction. And I think Ron DeSantis is one of them. And I think he could probably take a lesson out of Donald Trump's book of 2025, start practicing the politics of addition, and he'll go on and have a great political career.
Today, we are joined by Jamie Miller. His career in Florida politics spans nearly 30 years. Jamie's expertise and practical approach to politics has allowed him to be featured in nearly every major daily newspaper in the country. He's been the executive director of the Republican Party of Florida, a manager for a Senate campaign, a consultant, and an author. Most notably, he was the director of field operations during the infamous Florida recount in the 2000 election between Bush and Gore. These days, he's busy analyzing politics on his blog, Reasonable Arguments, and hosting a podcast of the same name with his wife, Jennifer Bash. So stay tuned for a seasoned professional's take on Ron DeSantis, the Trump administration, DOGE, the midterms, who will be the 2028 Republican presidential nominee, as well as practical advice on running campaigns and working in politics. The first thing I want to ask you about, it seems like you're a bit of a Ron DeSantis criticizer. You're not maybe his biggest fan. And I'm not either.
You know, the thing with Ron DeSantis is that he's been a great governor, like not a good governor, a great governor. And, you know, I criticize him politically, I think, a little bit, because I like to think of it, you know, he's not calling me up for advice. So I try to say, okay, well, to me, I think I'm giving him good advice, and or I'm putting good advice out in the world for him. And, you know, I know that some people see that as criticism. I kind of did the same thing with Trump, you know, when he was running in the primary, and, you know, I kind of just call it like I see it, you know, and then hopefully nobody holds too big a grudge over a long term to say, oh, this is a thing. I do. A lot of Republicans in Florida assume that because we now have a 1 million vote advantage, that if you win the primary in Florida, it's like South Carolina, you're going to win. Or you're like Utah, you're going to win. And that's not the case. It's, you know, we have 11 media markets here. You have to have run a very complicated, complex, well-funded strategic campaign to win statewide. And whether that's governor or whether that's one of the other statewide positions for cabinet or U.S. Senate that are all going to be up in 2026. And, you know, Democrats have if we have primaries and they don't, the other thing is our primary is so late in the cycle. It's the Tuesday before Labor Day. And so you're within So when you have the kind of a primary that splits somebody, especially at the top of the ticket, split the party at the top of the ticket. And Ron DeSantis had this in 2018. You know, he had this late primary. It was split. He won the primary because Donald Trump endorsed him. And then within about 90 or 92 days, you have a general election. So you have to put the party together. You're within 30 days of having mail-in ballots mailed to domestic voters, 30 days after our primary. So most, if you have a primary and your opponent doesn't, as a general rule, people end primaries with no money. And so you have to go raise money immediately to then be prepared to run some sort of mail-in ballot chase campaign. And it's complex, it's complicated. And if Republicans have primaries and Democrats don't, that's the scenario where I see Democrats could win some of these statewide offices. And I am in the minority view within the Republican Party on that, but I do believe that history, as my guide, is, you know, there were Republicans who won statewide races, Connie Mack in 1988, Jim Smith for Secretary of State back in 1990, when Democrats had a bigger advantage that percentage wise than Republicans have today. That was a very long answer to your very short question.
No, I'm kind of blown away that there's only 30 days after the primary to the general election for the state.
It's incredible.
I had no idea.
It's very fast. So in Florida, you really still count on the state party, which I'm a former executive director of the state Republican Party. And so especially in a non-presidential year, you really rely on, because that's when all of our statewide races are in the non-presidential year. You really have to rely on the party that be well-funded and well-organized so that the party then generally does that initial absentee ballot chase.
It is very fast. Well, what I really want to ask you about DeSantis, I was reading one of your blogs and you said it's hard to believe that after 6 years, DeSantis continues to make these political mistakes. How did the free state of Florida that has had majorities in the House, Senate, and cabinet since 1998 get this fragmented? And I was kind of hoping maybe you'd break down how fragmented it is, because I think most people think, oh, it's just a conservative, you know, paradise in Florida.
It is a conservative paradise, but it is, but it's not without work. It's not without 30 years, 40 years of long before I got involved in politics, and I've been involved here 25 plus years. And, you know, long before I was, people were committed to winning majorities in the state House, state Senate, and cabinet. And, you know, I would go back to that Connie Mack race in 1988, that breathed life into the Republican Party of Florida. And it wasn't until 1998, 10 years later, that we had a majority of the House, Senate. Jeb Bush won governor. And we won a majority, not even all of the cabinet positions, but a majority in the cabinet. So, so Ron DeSantis says things like, well, I've done this. Well, yeah, you have, but you've stood on the shoulders of many people. And it appears that he seems to sometimes neglect to appreciate that. And so I think there's people out there who are, you know, been around a long time. Dan Webster was our first Republican Speaker of the House after Reconstruction, the now U.S. Congressman. And, you know, that guy worked tirelessly to win majorities in the state House, super conservative guy. And now it's just, you know, for people not to recognize that is disheartening. And secondly, the latest thing, there's two things that have happened within the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks, was the immigration bill here in special session in Florida, where Donald Trump Ron DeSantis said he was supporting Donald Trump. And yet, you know, it was Donald Trump's, you know, main supporters in the state Senate who worked with the White House policy folks, Stephen Miller, Susie Wiles, things like that, who developed the bill that Ron DeSantis then said he was going to veto. And then he ran around the state and, you know, said, you know, not only am I going to veto this bill, I'm going to make sure all these Republicans have primaries. I'm going to raise money against them because they've gone against me on this. And, you know, we have a senator here who has been one of my dear friends, but Senator Joe Gruters, he's supported Trump since 2014 or 2012 even. Joe Gruters was a county party chairman and invited Donald Trump when the RNC convention was in Tampa, and Mitt Romney would not let Donald Trump speak. Joe Gruters gave Donald Trump our Statesman of the Year, just an hour south in Sarasota, Florida. And so they've been friends for, you know, 10, 15 years. And he's now a state senator. And he's Donald Trump has endorsed him for a statewide position we have in Florida called CFO. It's also the insurance commissioner, the fire marshal, the statewide fire marshal, all in one. And in this position called CFO. And, you know, so Joe ran the bills for Donald Trump. And then Ron DeSantis went around. And, you know, I saw Joe speak at the University of Florida. And he's like, listen, I'm fine, you know, because I have this shield called the President Trump, you know. But 100 legislators in Florida, 100 Republican legislators in Florida endorsed Ron DeSantis for president over Donald Trump. And he went around vilifying them and his closest friends, his closest allies, because of one issue. And, you know, that to me is fracturing the party. That's an example of it. And then, you know, of course, this week, Byron Donalds announces for governor last night. And last week, Ron DeSantis kind of slices Byron Donalds. Casey DeSantis kind of has a speech that's, you know, you can't have Republican light, speaking about Byron Donalds. Everyone's, you know, knows that that's what they were trying to stop Byron Donalds from announcing. And, you know, and it's just, why are you fighting the president? You know, like, why is Governor DeSantis not working with the president instead of fighting him on these issues? And I don't know the answer to that, but you can see a split. You can see it coming where you can see Donald Trump supporting a slate of candidates and Ron DeSantis supporting another slate. And, you know, that's the recipe that could end up costing Republicans some seats in Florida.
I know you said you don't know why he does that, but I mean, what's your instinct? Is it more Ron DeSantis has a big ego or is he incompetent? Because I watched him.
There's no question he's competent. There's no question he's competent. And so he's like I said, he's been a good governor, if not a great governor. And I mean, when we had a hurricane, Ian, and it wrecked Fort Myers Beach, a bridge to Sanibel Island. I'm sure a lot of people have, you know, come to Fort Myers and gone to Sanibel. That's a seashell capital of the world. And so the bridge to Sanibel was taken out, and the Army Corps of Engineers said, you know, it's going to take us 3 months to get the materials, to get whatever. And Ron DeSantis says, I was in the military. Like, we can build a bridge in 3 days. And he did. He built the bridge to Sanibel Island in 3 days. Now, it wasn't a great bridge. It wasn't, you know, but people could get out to their property. They could clean their property. And that's a big deal when you face a hurricane like this, especially if you're on a barrier island. And, you know, so it was just, there's no question he's competent. You know, that I don't want to come across as he's an incompetent person, because he is not. I say that he's probably the best politician I've seen in Florida who also tends to be tone deaf in politics. And, you know, and I've worked with people before. There's people who are very good at policy, but they're not really good at campaigns. And there's some who are very good at campaigns who aren't really good at the policy side. And very seldom do you find the two meet. And I would put him in the, you know, he's an okay campaigner. He's not a great campaigner, you know, and I mean, I think we all saw that during the presidential race. Like, he's a mediocre campaigner at best. And if we're going to be intellectually honest about it, you know, but he is great on the policy and the administrative side. In fact, I supported him to be Secretary of Defense, you know, I think in one of my blogs. And prior to Pete Hegseth being announced, I thought, well, that would be a great place for Ron DeSantis to then work with the president. And of course, the president went a different direction, and that's his prerogative. Like, it's fine by me. I, you know, I'm not like Ron DeSantis isn't one of my clients, so I just call it the way I see it, right? So,
okay, that's interesting, because from my take, I was always leaning towards maybe Ron DeSantis was kind of incompetent. I saw his presidential campaign, which I thought was a total train wreck, and what really always ticked me off. He would act like he was this anti-COVID lockdown guy, and he was beat his chest about it. And I'm thinking, pump the brakes, Ron. You shut the state down. You closed a bunch of stuff. I had to cancel my vacation because you closed it down. You were checking people's papers at the border. I'm not sure what world you're living in. You definitely locked stuff down. And I was thinking, did he not remember what he did, or is it just political lying?
I don't think it's that. I honestly think that it's kind of, you know, revisionist history. You always want to remember the best history, you know, sometimes coulda, woulda, shoulda. And I've always said, you know, when history looks back at that particular period of time, I think they're going to be, their history will be kind to everybody who was in leadership at that point, because people forget that, you know, the only thing we really had to go by were these crazy numbers coming out of Italy. But we, you know, and it was the doubling, it was a figure that concerned me. It was called doubling of the death rate, right? Like, so today, 3 people died, tomorrow, 6. You don't have to go 30 days before you're losing a population. And that was happening in Italy. Now we know that, you know, at the moment we didn't realize that it was this, but now we know that it was because Italy's population was so old, and that particular virus attacked older people with greater veracity than it did younger people. But or the younger people who were dying died because they had maybe a heart murmur they didn't know about, or they had, you know, they were on the verge of diabetes and they didn't know about it, and they were untreated medical conditions. And so I don't blame Andrew Cuomo for what he did. You know, I don't think that, you know, when we look back at that, especially those first 3 to 6 weeks, you know, now I think probably we closed the state around March 13th. And my guess is we opened it. I think our beaches almost throughout the state and everything were open by Memorial Day. So, you know, we did have this level, and things gradually opened. I know that golf courses, for the most part, were open. You had to be in your own cart, you know, and I don't know that things like golf courses ever closed, you know, to be honest with you. So when you look at things like that, you're like, okay, well, he didn't close the state, but there were restaurants, things were closed for a period of time that, you know, I guess the devil's in the details, but I don't blame Ron DeSantis. You know, he did a great job with COVID. I think the best a leader could do with the information they had at the time. And like I said, Andrew Cuomo made some different decisions that turned out worse, but I also don't blame him because, you know, nobody had real data. We were going by these crazy doubling of the death rate numbers out of Italy. And, you know, and that turned out to be a little bit skewed because their population was so skewed older.
Yeah, I remember it was a mess. I was living in Brooklyn when the lockdown happened, and it got so quiet. Ooh. I mean, New York is so loud, and then they did the lockdown for 2 weeks, and it was just dead on the streets. It was a little bit eerie, so I'm glad that's behind us. What do you think of Casey DeSantis? Yeah. Do you think she has a chance to be governor? I'm not a big fan of spouses and wives saying I'm qualified because my last name.
Yeah, I had a blog that on Reasonable Arguments, Substack. I posted on Substack that came out today that kind of looked at the history of wives and family members, you know, legacy family members like the John Adams and William Howard Taft and his son and the Roosevelts and the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Clintons. And, you know, so I picked those kind of legacy, you know, American legacy families, right, if you want to call them that. And they all had more losses than wins. And only in one case that I could find in a statewide race where a living husband passed the baton directly to their wife was George Wallace in Alabama in 1966. Now you could go to Texas and there's a Pa and Ma Ferguson back in the 20s and 30s. Pa Ferguson was impeached in 1917, and Ma Ferguson got elected in 1926, and then again in 1932. Then they elected their governor every 2 years. So, and she lost the 1928 race. So like, you know, so it, and, in both of those cases, the wife was seen as an extension of the husband's politics. He kept, quote, their political systems intact, the political patronage stayed intact. And to the level that there was corruption in the Texas case, the wife's administration was seen as just as corrupt. And so I don't think Casey DeSantis will be governor, but I also speculated that they were floating Casey DeSantis to try to slow down Byron Donald's momentum, his fundraising momentum. He's getting, you know, daily, he was already getting lots of people to endorse him, whether they were, you know, county Republican Party chairmen, state committee men and women, you know, county commissioners, state committee men, or state House, state Senate members. All of those folks have been, you know, Byron Donalds has done what he needed to do over the last 6 or 8 months for this moment for him to run for governor.
What's DeSantis's big beef with Byron Donalds? I mean, DeSantis can't run again.
Byron Donalds was a huge DeSantis supporter, which is a crazy thing. Matt Gaetz and Ron DeSantis, or and Byron Donalds were helped Ron DeSantis. They actually were the debate team for Ron DeSantis in 2018. They prepped Ron DeSantis for his debate. And in 2023, after 5 or 6 years of being completely loyal to one another, Ron DeSantis or Byron Donalds had the gall to, you know, kind of disagree with Ron DeSantis on a policy issue, which had to do with teaching African-American studies in Florida schools. And Byron Donalds disagreed with him. And so then Ron DeSantis says, you're out. And, you know, and I think from a more global standpoint, you know, this, I think this is kind of an interesting thing, because I say that the difference between Donald Trump 2017 and Donald Trump in 2025 is in 2017, Donald Trump practiced the politics of subtraction. And today he's practicing the politics of addition. It's a totally different president. And because he's bringing in people like Tulsi Gabbard and Elon Musk, and go down the list of people who in 2017, Marco Rubio, who would not be part, Vivek Ramaswamy early on, like, those folks would not have been part of a Donald Trump administration, and yet he's bringing those folks in. And there's a lot of folks who emulate Donald Trump in politics who are still practicing that 2016, 2017 version of Donald Trump with the politics of subtraction. And I think Ron DeSantis is one of them. And I think he could probably take a lesson out of Donald Trump's book of 2025, start practicing the politics of addition, and he'll go on and have a great political career.
Why did Trump change like that from subtraction to addition? Because I remember how much he hated Marco Rubio. I mean, it was such a neck and neck, like they hated each other. Yeah. And so to see him bring these people in the fold, is it just he just wanted to win presidency again? It's what you have to do.
I personally believe it was the assassination attempt. And I think he thought that me and my wife were in Milwaukee. My wife's not political at all. We do a podcast also called Reasonable Arguments. And so she asked me questions of just like, what's better, a mayor or a governor? Cause she has no idea. So we kind of do that. And then, but we were in Milwaukee. We were that Saturday, we were at a Brewers game in a skybox with a lot of Florida politicians, the state party chairman, Senator Gruters, Senator Fine, a lot of loyal Trump folks. And when we got news that there was an assassination attempt, we fortunately had a TV, so we flipped it over. And, you know, the tone in Milwaukee immediately changed to one of, while there was a tone of celebration, there was a tone of grace, I think might be the right word, of just people and gratefulness that President Trump survived that attempt on his life. And I think that it was that moment, because, you know, Donald Trump showed up Monday, he's on the floor Monday night. And my wife wrote a Facebook post that I included in my blog, but and like I said, she's not political, but she's sitting there, and our seats were in the second balcony, and or on the second, you know, whatever. And but they were right behind Donald Trump's seats. And so Donald Trump comes and sits down with his family, and here we are. And I look over and she's like tearing up. And I was like, are you okay? And she's writing, you know, on her phone and Facebook. And she's like, you know, just leave me alone a second. I'm like, okay. Then, you know, she writes this really, really deep post about, I can't believe that Donald Trump is so brave that he would come and sit, number one, in a room full of 13,000 people. But I'm behind him looking at his head. And just 48 hours ago, someone literally was trying to put a bullet through his head to kill him. And here there are, I'm sitting with thousands of two or 3,000 people who are behind him. And yet he has the bravery to, and trust in us that, you know, that that's not going to happen again. And so I think, and it was that kind of feeling throughout that whole week that I know Donald Trump must have felt. And I think that impacted his, I think it impacted him personally, and I think it impacted him politically. And I think that this politics of addition grew out of that.
I do want to ask you another Florida question, if that's okay. And then we'll get on to some more general national stuff. I've got a whole list here. I'm sorry. I'm very type A personality. And this is kind of, this is going to sound gossipy and like definitely something you would hear on a female podcast show. But I remember the Moms for Liberty scandal with the Ziegler's, what was it, about a year ago? Do you have any inside scoop on any of that? Did people know about that before it leaked to the press?
So absolutely not. So the, and the I live in Sarasota, and the Ziegler's are from Sarasota. And so Bridget Ziegler still sits on the Sarasota County School Board. And so to my knowledge, nobody, I have not heard of anyone who knew that that controversy was happening, where they were, both of them were seeking sexual partners to join them. And, you know, I'm not somebody who throws stones at glass houses. I don't care what you do in your bedroom. I appreciate if you don't peek in the window, and I don't want to peek in the window of yours. Right. And so, however, I did have a political mentor one time who was a pork chopper. We called him in Florida, country old. We just call them pork choppers because they go to any pork chop dinner in any church anytime. And that's how politics was run in Florida. And he would had this long drawl, you know, like you would expect. And he talked about, you know, one time about the Christian Coalition and how, you know, he would say, Jamie, I tell you one thing, if you decide to make your career on that piece of political dirt, you better be as clean as a December snow. Because one thing I know about the Christian Coalition is they will forgive, but they will never forget. So I always took that to heart. He's like, you know, you, Jamie, you drink and cuss too much to be, to put your career on that piece of political dirt. And I, so I always took him as at his word. And the Ziegler's did just that. They decided to make their entire political careers about being cleaner than a December snow, when they would criticize LGBTQ community to the worst degrees. And so, I mean, we can talk about that politically, and I'm sure you and I would probably agree on most of those things, but I'm a live and let live. If you're an adult, go do adult things. And, you know, it's not my business. When it starts affecting tax dollars or kids, then it becomes our business. And so, you know, but they were out there vilifying that community while they were participating in it. And I think it's the hypocrisy that they have a hard time, they'll have a hard time overcoming to get back into the political realm.
What's what I find so jarring right now is the Christian right, definitely, they love Trump. I mean, that's, they're all on board for him. And Christians can be rather judgmental to people, to their face. I know, I've experienced it. But then they just kind of look the other way. You know, I mean, she's still on the board, and you can look at Trump's administration. I like some things Trump does, but it's pretty evident with his cabinet. There's a lot of questionable behavior and past from some of those people. Hegseth, RFK admitted lust demons and a worm in his brain. I mean, there's some weird folks that circle around Donald Trump. And I just wonder, when is the Christian right going to wake up and go, hold on, hold on, we're a little hypocritical. But do you think it'll ever happen, or they just drank the Kool-Aid?
You know, I put it under the political philosophy of better the devil you know. And Donald Trump is certainly closer aligned to the Christian Coalition than anything the Democrats can put up. And so I think they accept, you know, the devil they know. And that's Donald Trump. And so, you know, that's just, I think, you know, we're probably, you know, I think the Christian Coalition, you know, that group would probably rather have somebody like Mike Pence, right? And so if you're able, it's probably a few years before Mike Pence probably makes it through the primary process for president.
We all saw that guillotine that was out there for him on January 6th. I don't think he's got a comeback coming, do you?
You know, I do believe Americans allow a comeback, you know, but it takes either the politician doing something. You know, I always said Dan Quayle could have become president if he would go back and become the governor of Indiana, and that, but he felt that it was beneath the vice president to serve as governor. And so that's why Dan Quayle remains the, you know, former vice president and never even ran for president. And so, so I think people will forgive, but you have to kind of do something to reinvent yourself. I don't know that Mike Pence has done that.
While we're on the Trump administration, I wanted to ask you about James Carville. He said a few days ago he thinks the whole administration is going to collapse in 30 days, but you've been around politics as long as he has. What is your take on that?
Yeah, he's wrong. But I don't blame him for thinking that way, because in the old Donald Trump, right, the first term Donald Trump, you know, I think Democrats probably did Republicans a favor by stealing that 2020 election, because if Donald Trump had won it, it would have just been more of the same. Like, he would have done his best, which he did in his first term, but it would have been an extension of his first term. After he lost that 2020 election, he had 4 years to plan exactly what he wanted to do, the mistakes he had made, and correct them. And I think you're seeing that come to fruition. You know, not that Democrats still have more judges and justices than throughout the country than Republicans. And so, you know, that's for having the presidency for 12 out of the last 16 years. And so, you know, but so that's where they're going to try to stop Trump. And I think you saw this as something different in the campaign. Number one, I think Americans are in a different spot. In 2020, Americans who were on the fence decided not to vote for Donald Trump because of the fires he set. And, you know, a lot of people would talk about his tweets, his whatever. And so by the time 2024 came around, people wanted somebody to lead us through fire, and they accepted Donald Trump to lead us through fire despite the fires he sets, because they didn't even think Kamala Harris would lead us through fire. And so, you know, I think number one, the Americans are in a different spot because they're seeing kind of the fraud that has been perpetuated upon them and their children and grandchildren with the amount of debt we have and what that debt was going towards. And of course, we're seeing the wealth of these politicians grow for no absolute reason other than Nancy Pelosi got a $14 million grant from USAID for a winery that they owned. And so, you can accumulate a lot of wealth if people give you blank checks. And so, for tens of millions of dollars. And so I think people are disgusted by it. And so I think that level of disgust. And the other thing that is different, and I'll say this because she's here from Florida, is Susie Wiles. And most people don't know Susie Wiles. Susie Wiles, you know, was the campaign manager for Governor Rick Scott when he ran. I worked on that campaign with Susie. She came in 2018 and saved Ron DeSantis's campaign at the end. And then Ron DeSantis, you know, fired her for no reason other than she did what she was asked. And I don't know how to make it any more plain than that. And then she worked with Donald Trump, and Susie brings a level of calm and strategy and discipline that I don't think Donald Trump had in the West Wing in his first term. So I disagree with James Carville that this thing's going to implode. You know, that some of these things may not happen, or they may be delayed because of court orders. And, you know, if the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't stop some of these lower court rulings, then, you know, we could see a delay in some of these things being implemented. But what we've seen from federal government employees in the past is, even if there were court orders, and we saw this with executive orders, that employees just decided not to implement them. And so, you know, we'll see. It's kind of going to be a battle between the branches of government, I guess.
Well, here's my thing. Maybe you can help parse this out about the whole federal government employees, layoffs, DOGE. As much as I would love a smaller government, and we're far too big, I'm very libertarian. It could be very, very tiny, our government, and I would be much happier. I don't look at some other bureaucrat maybe making $50,000 a year just trying to feed their family with some probably ridiculous government job, but they've had it for a while, as my enemy. And I see conservatives just salivating online, like they're cheering it on. They're so happy that someone lost their job. And I think that might come back and bite Republicans in the rear end for the midterms, because taking glee in someone else's pain is just not a good look, I don't think.
Well, one thing we need to be intellectually honest about is that the average salary in America is about $60,000 a year, and the average federal employee makes 30% more than the average American, and they don't want to go to work, and they're working from home. I've had some on, not on my podcast, but I've interviewed some for my blog who have, like, you know, you can't get a hold of anybody on a Friday, you know? And so, people don't join their Zoom calls, or they join a Zoom call and you don't see their face because they're text, you know, whatever they're doing. And now we saw the problem with, you know, the private chat rooms that all these government employees are in, that they're talking about, you know, all sorts of sexual things and all sorts of, I had one person tell me, he's like, oh, no, it's not just that. We talk about farming and gardening and skiing and vacations. And, you know, it's like, we're at the water cooler all day, and, you know, yeah, we get some work done and whatever, listen, I have lots of friends who are good, you know, I'd like to think are good federal employees. The truth of the matter, it has nothing to do with them. Right now, the number, and I've written about this in the blog as well, that, you know, when a corporation lays people off, on average, a corporation has layoffs, they lay off 18.5% of their employees. We're not even close to that. We're not even close to 5%. And so, and most of that 5%, if it's 5%, it's not. But even if it's, you know, 3.5%, most of that fall into two categories. One, people who were in their 90-day probationary period and they don't have any, you know, they're at-will employees and they're let go. And the others are, you know, jobs that are unfilled, that are taken off of job boards, so they can't be filled. So the number of people being laid off, so out of the 3.5 to 5%, let's even call it 5, out of the 5%, 3% of that fall into those two categories, and maybe 1 to 2% are actual people who are putting their stuff in a box and leaving an office. Now, out of that 2%, half of them aren't even leaving an office. They're just working from home already. So, you know, and with really very little oversight or anything, you know, if somebody can't write a 5-point thing of what you did last week, you know, somebody's like, well, Elon Musk doesn't know what I do. I was like, wouldn't you use that as an opportunity to let him know? Like, why wouldn't you educate him on how important your job is and why, you know, what you're doing for the American people and its importance versus fighting, you know, City Hall on it. And instead you're fighting City Hall. And if you're going to do that, you're going to fight the President of the United States or his representatives, you should be fired. You work on behalf of the President of the United States.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely laziness. I knew somebody had a work from home job since COVID, and they said they just go every 15 minutes and move the mouse to make it look like they were working. So those people I'm not super upset over because you're grifting. I guess my main beef, and then we can get off of it, but I think these layoffs are just, there are trillions of dollars missing in the Pentagon. There's been so many miscalculated things on the ledger. We don't even know if there's gold in the Federal Reserve. It's not been audited. And I feel like it's really bad optics and just kind of a stupid place to start with the layoffs when my main beef is with the Pentagon and the Federal Reserve, because it's such a small part of like saving money for the government.
And so I think you have to start with the layoffs, not because of the amount of money you're saving, but because the amount of people who will fight Trump from within. And that's what this is really about. It's about getting rid of the people who see their political opinions as above the elected president of the United States for whom they work. And that is, those are the employees who are going first. So anybody who's being fired, it's most likely because they have used their government non-political positions to support and put forth political agendas. And those folks should not be in government. And so, yes, I feel bad for the children. I feel, you know, I feel bad for anybody who's lose their job. I was like, you know, I always say that, you know, being a political consultant's like being a radio disc jockey, you know, that I've been fired more than Howard Stern, you know, so, you know, so it's part of what I sign up for. Now I know government employees sign up for a level of stability and that, you know, supposedly it's like, oh, I get paid less, but the truth is at the federal level, they don't get paid less. They get paid 30% more than the average American. They get better retirement than the average American, healthcare, more days off than the average American. So, you know, these are pretty, regardless of what position you serve, all of those things are true. And so, you know, I'm not going to pick apart the one person who just started a job and is at $40,000 or $45,000 a year, but averages are averages. And we're talking about millions of employees across the federal government, you know, to get to those averages. And so, you know, the numbers are what the numbers are, you know? And so I think we have to start with that, that federal employees make 30% more than the average American, period, the end. So why are we paying our federal employees if we're doing all these other special things for them?
So you don't think this will play out negatively for the midterms? Like people get mad about what's going on?
Listen, the Democrats are going to try to do everything they can, right? And so we'll see. The midterms are forever
away. I know. They are, but time moves fast, it seems like.
Yeah, so we're 4 or 5 weeks in here, you know? So it's... And think of all that's happened in the last month. Now multiply that by, you know, 17 or by 15, however many months we are away from the midterms. So I do think Americans will either embrace Trump or reject him in the midterms, and the U.S. House will move by 30 to 50 seats one way or the other.
Who do you think will be the next Republican nominee? Because Trump this week dodged crowning Vance, which personally, in my opinion, I'm glad I'm not a big Vance fan. So I was like, okay, maybe somebody else.
You know, it'll be interesting. You know, you would think that J.D. Vance has the upper hand. Certainly Governor DeSantis wants to get it, but he's out of office in 2026 and no longer has the bully pulpit of the governor's mansion of Florida. You know, you look around the country and there's these other cast of characters who still want to be president, right? And probably two or three we don't know of. And so, you know, I imagine it will be we'll see. I think a lot of it will depend on the midterms. You know, do Trump's endorsed candidates win primaries and then general elections? And does the U.S., you know, the U.S. Senate's probably a pretty boring place to make a prediction, just because, you know, there's like two Republican seats and two Democratic seats, and Republicans are likely to hold on to the majority in the U.S. Senate, regardless of how bad the political environment is, you know. But in the House, I think you could move, you know, quite a few seats. You know, you could pick across the country. If you have this 8-point swing in a midterm, you know, you start talking about 20, 30, you know, 50 seats that could, you know, despite the gerrymander and despite all the rest of it, you know, there's, if Trump were to have a plus 10 election in 2026 in Florida, there's probably two or three congressional seats that could go Republican that aren't right now. And we are, you know, 2/3 Republican seats already. And so, you know, so I think certainly in California, there's 3 to 5. You know, you look at Illinois, there's probably a couple. New York has 3 to 5. And, you know, you kind of dance your way across the country into this, you know, you could have a landslide. And Democrats could take the same, you know, look in the mirror and say the same thing. If Trump's, you know, not, if people aren't excited about Trump. I mean, it's going to be about the economy. It's going to be about inflation. If you know, bird flu is driving eggs, so they're trying to pick on eggs, you know. But, you know, if those are all persistent problems in, you know, April, May of next year, you know, then Republicans could be in the hot seat in 2026.
if you had to pick someone that you thought would be the best to run in 2028 to carry on MAGA, who would you think that would be? Just in your professional, personal opinion.
You know, I'll be honest. Like, I think Marco is great, you know, and not just because he's a friend. He's a true believer in freedom and personal responsibility. And I know that just from knowing the man for more than 25 years. And in fact, if one of my office mates at the Republican Party of Florida went to the Berlin Wall and had a chip of the Berlin Wall on his desk where he took a chip of the Berlin Wall when the Berlin Wall fell. And Mark, this is one of Marco's close friends, and Marco came in and he was holding that, you know, it was on a little marble thing with a little chip, right? And he's holding that in his hand and he's just like, yeah, I remember this. And I guess they went on the trip together. And he goes, anytime communism falls, I want to be there. And it was just, you know, this is 2001, 2003, something like that. And I just remember that just was like such a profound thing to say. You know, his parents fled communism, and you know, I think Marco would make a great president. Whether you want to say he's going to carry be the standard bearer for MAGA or not, I don't know. But you know, he was certainly somebody who I think Americans would embrace as president. I think J.D. Vance, you know, would be a good one. We'll see if Ron DeSantis can start practicing the politics of addition instead of subtraction. I think he has to do that if he's going to be considered, you know, a presidential nominee before 2036, 2040, you know, and then, you know, you could see a scenario where a Nikki Haley, not a MAGA person, but you could see a Nikki Haley, you know, if things turned against Trump, right? If the national environment turns against Trump, you could see a Nikki Haley waiting in the wings to make another run to be that person. I don't think she gets there. I kind of have the same reaction you do, but you asked me to call it like I see it. And so I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm just, you know, kind of saying that I do think that there could be an environment that exists that's to the left of the MAGA movement, but not all the way to the center. And I think that's where Nikki lives. I think a dark horse could be Sarah Huckabee. I think she would be a great standard bearer for the party. You know, Ashley Moody, the new U.S. Senator from Florida, maybe won't have enough federal experience by 2028, but she certainly probably would be considered, depending on how 2026 goes, for vice president. I like love for Americans to get to know her better. She's been a great attorney general here in Florida. You know, so there's no shortage of, you know, of the bench for Republicans, for sure.
Sure hope it's not Nikki Haley, though. I don't know.
I'm not endorsing anyone. I'm just saying, depending on the environment, yeah, there could be an environment where she survives.
She gives me the ick like Kamala, man. Wow.
I think she's much more well-spoken and a much better command of the issues than Harris, for sure. But I agree with you. She's probably more moderate than I would prefer. But you know, you have to win. What we've seen, especially from Doge, is that if you don't win, you can't make a difference, right? And so we have to win. And so that's imperative that Democrats not win the White House after the changes that Trump makes here in this term.
Before I let you go, I was wanting to tap into a little bit of your campaign experience, because like I said, I was snooping all over your website. And online it said that you were the campaign manager during a U.S. Senate campaign in crisis for a sitting member of Congress. Now, if you can't say who it is, that's okay. I would like to know what the crisis was, because I'm a nosy person. But what would be your, if you were a consultant, if you were running a campaign, how do you get a campaign out of crisis?
How do you manage a campaign in crisis?
How do you steer a campaign out of crisis into victory, if that one even turned into victory?
So that one did not turn into victory. It still could have. We got through the crisis. The campaign, and I try not to do it because I she and I don't get along, and even now, and she's from Sarasota, is Catherine Harris. And so when I was working for her, she was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in and listed as Congressman Woman B in an indictment in the MZM scandal. And so, which was kind of a 2003 or four type scandal. That her race was in 2006. And it was a basically a lobbying scandal. And so she was accused of taking beyond limits and using money personally. And it was a very, very, because strong-willed people, and I don't know that I want to go into it that much, but strong-willed people want to correct it. They, you know, I want to explain it. And so, you know, she's like, I'll go over to the Department of Justice and sit down right now. And I was working with a very high-powered team, Ed Rollins, Ronald Reagan's. You can see Ronald Reagan over my shoulder, campaign manager from 1984, who's going to be on our podcast tomorrow as a guest. And then Ben Ginsburg, who's the high-powered D.C. attorney still and was recount fame at the time. And this powerful group of consultants who were trying to guide her through this crisis. And, you know, I was trying to manage up to the consultants and manage down to the staff. And, you know, of course, all of these, you know, local reporters are walking into the headquarters, you know, and I had to kind of segregate a spot for like, hey, listen, if you're going to come do this, we're not having a press conference. And so I would kind of try to, and I was the campaign manager, so I would try to, you know, be as professional as I could while not answering any questions because it was a legal issue. It was a legal issue, not a political issue. And so the one thing that people don't really understand in that moment, in a moment like that, is that when you have an incumbent member of Congress, and this would be my advice to Byron Donalds, you know, maybe not right now, but come January, you should resign and commit to running for governor. Because when you have a congressional staff and you're trying not to miss votes and you're trying to, you know, everybody pulls on a member of Congress, you know, the campaign staff, regardless of even a member of Congress who's running for reelection, there's just so much time and it takes a lot of time and effort to raise money to do the job. And so I always tell people, go do your job well, and then that will set you up well to run for the reelection or your next office. And so that has to be the priority for every sitting elected officials. Do your job well. And then, you know, then let's run the campaign. And so let's work the campaign as hard as we can. And, you know, in a situation like that, it's kind of a lot of the communications comes out of the official campaign or congressional office versus the campaign office. And that's not something that, you know, members of the staff want to do. The members of the staff are like, we want to go protect our person. We want to go take the hill. And so sometimes it's just managing like, no, we're going to dig this bunker and we're going to keep our heads down for 24 hours or 48 hours. And we're going to see, you know, how we can come out of it. And we plan a strategy to go and, you know, and talk about it and explain what happened, why we're taking the actions we are, and why you're, you know, mentioned in this document, but you're not indicted, an unindicted co-conspirator, right? And so there's not enough evidence to indict you. That's ultimately why you're unindicted. And so, so yes, your name is listed here. And going back and, you know, looking at what we know about federal employees, you know, the Bush administration did not really like Catherine at that point in time. And, you know, so it didn't surprise me that they would kind of throw a sortie over the bow, so to speak.
Okay. So running a campaign that's in crisis, basically just don't make it worse for yourself.
Here's the thing. You don't have to be quiet, you know, but you have to take a breath, count to 10 and think about not only your next step, but your next 10 steps. And, you know, what are the potential outcomes? What are your opponents going to say? What's the electorate going to say? What are your donors going to say? You know, depending on how you zig, are they going to zag? And so I'm not saying you just dig a hole. In this particular case, the campaign staff dug a bunker and the official staff took over the communications and the legal wrangling of that particular situation. And, you know, of course I worked with them on that and, you know, with Ben and everybody trying to work out that. So we balanced both the, you know, and worked with her chief of staff and, but it didn't reach staff level for either side. Right. So it's kind of, we kept it high and tight. And then we, you know, we expected, you know, I expected my staff and he expected the official staff to, you know, either stick, I always say you stick with the program or you quit. And, you know, sometimes you know, if it's that strong, you have that strong an opinion, you should quit. And, you know, in that particular case, nobody on the staff quit. Now we ended up leaving that campaign, in mass about 2 months later, but that was over a different issue.
Okay. Interesting. I went to college, went to grad school, and they never teach you about how to run a campaign. And I'm thinking, how do we get the power if you don't teach us how to run a campaign? So you just run furiously reading books and stuff to figure out the tricks.
I tell people there's not a business school in the world that tells you to start at zero, raise millions of dollars and end at zero, and you're successful. That it's just not, it's not taught anywhere. And so it's taught through the lessons of hard knocks. That's it. You have to just you have to go out and do it, or you're fortunate enough. I was fortunate enough to very early in my career work with people who had a lot of lessons through hard knocks and took me under their wing and shared those lessons before I could make the mistakes myself. And I made plenty of mistakes on top of it still, but you know how it goes.
I wanted to end with like a lightning round here of some questions.
Yeah.
So what is the best book on political strategy or analysis you would suggest someone read if they wanted to get into this business?
You know, there's one that I liked and it's probably old now, but it's a book called Get Out the Vote. And I've had it on my shelf for 25 or 30 years, but it's the one book that I had, and there may have been some since then, that showed the empirical data of grassroots activity. And you know, if you're winning big, then, you know, grassroots, okay, yeah, you have to do some things, you know, but you look at something, I was the director of field operations for the 2000 election for George W. Bush and the recount, and it was grassroots activities that saved us. And, you know, we had 6 million votes cast, and there was a difference of 537 between George W. Bush and Al Gore, and after 37 days of recount. And so, so it was those, I'm very proud of my staff from that period of time and the work that they did to save the presidency. And it was their door to door, their mail programs, their, mail-in at the time we called them absentee ballot campaign. And also critically was, poll watching that we implemented, especially in Broward County that, turned out to be just critical to saving that race.
What is the best campaign in U.S. history, like to model one after, that was well-managed, efficient?
I would say since Ed Rollins is going to be on my blog tomorrow, I'd say Ronald Reagan's 1984 race when he won 49 states. So
can't beat that. That's pretty successful. I noticed
Richard Nixon in 1972 won 49 states as well, I think. But those are the only two.
The only two. Okay. I noticed you had a book on your website of speeches, and I was wondering if you could tell me what is the best speech that you think you've heard, either in your book, not in your book.
Yeah, I wrote a collection of, you know, introductions of a collection of speeches called American Speeches That Changed History. Probably my favorite speech is a Reagan speech, the Berlin Wall speech, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It was a historic moment. Just because I worked with George W. Bush, his speech from the World Trade Centers after the 9/11 attacks on the back of the fire truck was the shortest speech in that book. But talk about a man who was a few words, but could make them count in the moment and understood the moment. He did that day, and the country followed him, you know. So, but I also have, you know, Patrick Henry, you know, I know not what course other men will take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And I think there's three speeches in there from JFK, and all my Republican friends say, how can we have so many speeches from JFK? And it was, you know, JFK is this interesting character in our history. You know, he had the, you know, we're going to the moon speech, and he had the Cuban Missile Crisis speech, and of course his first inaugural address, and he was in this such a particular moment of time when, you know, Russians had put Sputnik up in 1958. You know, we had the Brown versus Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court case in 1954, and here he wins the election as a young man, World War II hero, in 1960. So you have this, and you have technology, foreign policy, and domestic strife, Vietnam War, all of that in this one period of time. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, if he had lived and had a second term, what would the country look like? And, you know, we can only speculate, but I do speculate that we would be in better shape today than we are now.
What is the best commentator on the left and on the right?
I love James Carville. You mentioned him earlier. I had a chance to meet him. And in one of his books, he says, I love to read Republican consultant books. And so, but I get them all from the library, so I don't give them any money. And so when I met James Carville, I was like, I love all your books. I read them all. He's like, but I get them from the library. And he's like, oh, you must have read it, you son of a bitch. You know, like, you know, in his Cajun, I guess that was me being Cajun, but, you know, very poorly. And so I think for the most part, James Carville comes from a place of common sense. And that's okay. Kind of where I try to come from. And, you know, and if you read a little bit about him, his mother was an encyclopedia salesperson, and he was just a character. On the right, I have a picture somewhere of me and Sean Hannity right there.
Okay.
Kind of there, he's in the middle of that guy with the light blue shirt. Okay. So I'd have to say Sean Hannity just because I met him, and I have a picture of him on the wall, but I like Sean. There's, you know, I was a Rush Limbaugh fan. And in fact, one of my first papers was in an intro to psychology class called How Rush Limbaugh Changed My Life and Inspired Me to Get Into Politics. And so, without Rush Limbaugh, I probably am not sitting here in front of you today with the career that I've had. And so, so I would have to say to this day, still, I think Rush Limbaugh was the best.
I agree. He's my favorite. I remember listening to him when I was in a car seat, my mom would turn him on. So probably why I'm as messed up as I am now and love politics.
You don't sound messed up at all.
Well, good. I'm glad you think I'm sane. Let's see. What would you do if you weren't working in politics?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you have these moments in time. And one of my moments in time, I went back to college late. I had a 9-year career at electric utility and blue collar jobs, and went back to college after I was married, had 2 children. And after I graduated, I had kind of a path to go into political PR or sports PR. And so, you know, it's one of those moments like, man, I probably would have been really good at sports PR too, you know, like, but, you know, I took the path I took, and, you know, so that's probably where I would have been. I probably would have been working in sports somewhere.
That would have been way less stressful, I bet.
I don't know. Probably about the same.
Really? Okay.
Anytime you're dealing with people who are making lots of money, it's a
high stakes environment.
It's stressful.
What is your best piece of advice for someone who wants a career in politics? And I ask this for myself and for my other millennial friends who have a hard time getting into politics. That's a lot of who you know instead of what you know. So what is your best advice to navigate that?
Here it is. Over my shoulders here, one is the recount paper that's actually a color copy that we all signed of the recount, including James Baker and all of us. And my boss got the original, but he made color copies for all of us. And the other one is a former Speaker of the House who wrote a letter saying that, giving me credit for what me and my staff did to save the presidency in 2000. And I would just tell people, my dad was a minister. My mom was a social worker. I received free or reduced lunch throughout my entire high school, the elementary and high school. And so we were not political people. And if you are interested, roll your sleeves up and go help somebody you believe in. And my first person I believed in was a lady named Karen Krause. And she was running for county commissioner in Sumter County, Florida, which many of people may know now where the villages are, right? The largest retirement community in the world. But at the time, it was a lot of cow pastures and watermelons. And I believed in her. And so I took her door to door in my neighborhood, and she won that election. And she made me proud throughout her entire career. And I never regretted working for her and helping her become, or volunteering for her. I didn't work for her, I volunteered. And then I became, at that time, I became the youngest Republican Party county chairman in the state. With Karen's help now, she was the first Republican county commissioner elected in Sumter County since Reconstruction. And I would just say that one person can make a difference, because in a state like Florida, where 537 votes determine the presidency, we had at that time about 900 precincts. So about one half of one vote per precinct determined the presidency of the United States. And, you know, but I do think that you have to try to determine who you are and work and surround yourself around people who you believe in. And the truth is, some of them are going to let you down. Some of them may even stab you in the back. And you just kind of, if it's your passion and you believe in yourself and you believe in the country enough and you believe in your side, whether you're Democrat or Republican, just stick with it. And, you know, I like to say that I'm in the process of becoming an overnight success now. Like, I've got this kind of great career, you know, but I Whoopi Goldberg has a great quote, and I shouldn't quote Whoopi Goldberg on a conservative show, but it's a great quote about her movie career that applies. I like to say it applies to my political career. And Whoopi Goldberg would say, I had some very small parts in some very big films, and I had a very big part in some very small films. And that's kind of been my political career. I've had a very big part in some very small races. One of my proudest races is running a bond for little old Hendry County, Florida, to have an emergency room in a rural area. And that was about 10 years ago. And we passed that bond narrowly, and probably has, you know, that's a huge farming community. It's down at the south end of Lake Okeechobee between Miami and Fort Myers. And there have been thousands of people saved because of that emergency room out in that rural community. And so I'm really proud of that. Nobody, you know, it's never going to be in a book. I'm never going to make Fox News because of it. It's never, but I'm real proud of that race and what that did for that community. And I was just pretty well positioned to help them get through the hurdles that they needed to get through to have that electoral success. And, so you have that. And then you have, you know, I was a senior advisor on Newt Gingrich's failed presidential campaign in Florida. And then, of course, George W. in 2000 is kind of, you know, one of the big things that, you know, that I had. So I don't know if I answered your question. I think I strayed from it.
I think I got the gist of it. Just do what you're passionate in, and everything kind of falls into place. Would you
say? Yeah. And realize that you're probably, it'd be great if you become George Stephanopoulos or James Carville, and at 26 or 28, you happen to catch lightning in the bottle with a guy named Bill Clinton who remains loyal to you. Right. And so, that doesn't happen for most people. And so it's more of a slog, and you try to work with good people and, you know, decide if you're, you know, if you want to go lobby or if you want to go do, you know, how you're going to pay the bills along the way. Cause running campaigns is like farming. You know, for most of my career, I made 80% of my money in 4 months out of every 24. And so it's like, after that 4 months, I'm fat and happy. But then it's like, so you have to have a plan to kind of continue picking up races and to continue to do work. I do a lot of grassroots, grass tops activities, a lot of public relations activities, and a little bit of government relations to, you know, and now I do the blog and the podcast and all those things. And, you know, they don't pay much, but they're, I love doing it. Like I've loved this show. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming on. I was excited, like I said, when I got your email, and I love picking people's brains. So I learned a lot from you. Where would someone want to go online to find you if they heard this and say, I like this guy? Where can they hear your podcast? What's your website?
Yeah, so we're on, and you're going to love my wife more. She's much more exciting and funny than I am. You can reach us at reasonablearguments.com is our website, and that's kind of a portal to everywhere. But you can find us on YouTube or Apple or whatever your podcasts are at Reasonable Arguments. And then my blog is on Substack. And it's also at Reasonable Arguments. But if you want to follow me on Twitter or wherever, it's probably best just to go to reasonablearguments.com. Or you can Google Jamie Miller, Florida Republican. You probably have to put in some sort of qualifiers like that, or you'll end up getting a singer or an artist or somebody who's more important than I am.
Now that you know where we've been, find out where we're going. Tune in to Ladies Love Politics, where you can stay informed without going insane.